Welcome to New Books in Military History. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. One of the greatest challenges American military leaders have faced since the American Revolution has been how to motivate individual citizens to forego their own sense of private identity in favor of the collective group needed to wage war effectively. This problem becomes more acute in the 20th century when mass conscript armies were raised from a widely disparate American landscape of ethnic enclaves and highly localized regional communities. These challenges and the United States Army's response from the start of the Second World War through the Cold War until the end of the Vietnam War is the subject of Christopher DeRosa's book, Political Indoctrination in the U.S. Army from World War II to the Vietnam War. DeRosa investigates the cultures and mechanisms of creating political cohesion in the draftee army during the heyday of American conscription. Clearly an example of the so-called new military history, focusing on the intellectual and cultural legacy of a military institution, Chris DeRosa's book also represents just the sort of synthesis of military and social history that is at the core of the war and society approach, in that it places military institutions squarely within the context of the societies they serve. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Dr. Wintermute.
It's good to hear from you again, Chris.
Good to hear from you as well. Thanks for inviting me.
So today we're talking with Christopher DeRosa, author of the book Political Indoctrination in the U.S. Army, from World War II to the Vietnam War. I've read Chris's book, and I do recommend it for anyone interested in how the Army sought to inculcate its citizen-soldier conscripts and volunteers with a sense of common identity and purpose during the heyday of conscription. While clearly an example of the so-called new military history, focusing on the intellectual and cultural legacy of a military institution, Chris DeRosa's book also represents just the sort of synthesis of military and social history that lies at the core of the war and society approach, in that it places military institutions squarely within the context of the societies they serve. Chris, can you say a few words about yourself and what led you to pursue this project?
Absolutely. Well, I am a student of Dr. Russell Wigley's, one of the deans of American military history when he was at Temple University in Philadelphia. And I'm now an associate professor of history at Monmouth University in West Long Branch, New Jersey, where I teach courses on the Second World War, on the Cold War, on the Civil War and Reconstruction, and on United States political history. I was recently done with being the director of our master's program here at Monmouth, and it's a great place to be. Very enjoyable colleagues and a terrific environment for scholars and for students. And I've always been interested in military history and its nexus with political history. Going back to my undergraduate days, my senior thesis was on the attempt to woo soldier votes by the Republicans and the Democrats in the election of 1864, which is the first major election in which active duty soldiers could vote. After working on that stuff and getting to graduate school, my interests migrated to the 20th century, and I began working on a project about kind of replicating this earlier project centered on the 1952 election, because I thought that would be a very interesting one to study, because you had this recent sort of wave of anger amongst the nation's conservatives and Republicans over Harry Truman's dismissal of Douglas MacArthur. And you had the commander-in-chief's party, although not the commander-in-chief himself, running on one side of the ticket, and a very popular military figure in General Dwight D. Eisenhower running on the other side of the ticket. And I very much wanted to see where the military would kind of come down in trying to influence that vote one way or another as it prepared materials to allow soldiers to vote. And what I found out pretty quickly was that the military is very scrupulous about, or especially was in the 1950s, about playing it straight down the middle, showing no favoritism to the two major political parties in matters pertaining to elections. And that's an interesting, you know, or an important point in itself, but I also wanted to get a bigger picture of how the military and the government who holds the military reins try to use the engines of opinion making to influence its soldiers. And that was the genesis of this project.
But in the beginning of the book, you raise the prospect of a innate incompatibility for many Americans when it comes to the subject of military service, or at least a disconnect that lasted until the transition to the all-volunteer force in the 1970s. Can you describe this in greater detail for our listeners?
Are you speaking of the a conflict in the sort of individuals' right to sort of have their way and make your own way in the world, and the concept of national service, or required service?
No, I'm thinking more of a deep-seated cultural antipathy reaching back to the colonial period.
Well, you know, there's a dilemma, of course, for Americans that we pride ourselves on, especially within our military tradition. And you go back to the Revolutionary War, there's a story frequently cited whenever you want to say anything political to the Army, or tell the Army to do anything whatsoever, that Baron von Steuben was supposed to have said that German soldiers, you could tell them what to do and they would do it. American soldiers, you have to tell them why they have to do something and then they'll do it. This is probably apocryphal. We don't know that von Steuben actually said this, but it's so self-flattering that it continues to be trotted out on occasion. The Americans don't like to think that they've surrendered any fundamental aspects of their freedom in serving in the military, and yet this is, of course, is a bit of a dilemma, and how the society manages to finesse that dilemma, you can see in a number of ways. And I'll give you just one. At the beginning of the program, you talked about how the book is located in the conscription era, and you use the phrase conscripts and conscription. And in fact, in my original manuscript, I use those phrases interchangeably with draftee. Conscript and draftee, because conscript is not a pejorative term as far as I'm concerned. One person who read the manuscript, though, was very upset at that use of that word, because he felt it had a strong negative connotation. A conscript was not what these American draftees were. Conscript implied that somehow to this person that it meant unwilling conscript. And that's not necessarily the case. And I agreed with this person enough to sort of remove the term conscript so I could be clear that to be drafted in the 20th century, or to wait to be drafted, did not carry necessarily a negative connotation. It might in certain families, in certain military traditionally, families with military traditions, you don't maybe wait to get drafted. But in general, no one's manhood is on the line if you sort of wait to get drafted, and if as long as you're sort of serving willingly and cheerfully once you do that. The surrounding of the draft with patriotic rituals it was kind of a way of bridging this dilemma that you're talking about with one's individual you know, control of one's destiny and the idea of having to buy into a community's orders.
What were the antecedents for the type of political indoctrination you describe as taking shape in World War II?
Well, the most important antecedents are really come around with the French Revolution. When we try to give an American origin to this, what we'll get back to is Thomas Paine. When the Continental Army is fleeing across New Jersey is about to pivot after crossing the Delaware and turn back. You know, Thomas Paine has written some inspirational words for the army, which George Washington has read aloud to the troops, actually, who are going back across the Delaware the other way. And this includes, of course, the Times That Try Men's Souls crisis paper. And everybody knows the beginning of that. These are the Times That Try Men's Souls. The end was especially more troop indoctrination oriented, that if we don't do this, then these Hessians are going to have their way with our women. I'm not using his exact words. And we're going to be the race, we're going to give birth to a race on this continent whose fathers they shall doubt of, meaning, you know, did our fathers have courage, and are our fathers even our fathers, or are they these German mercenaries? So it's sort of a, you know, sexual threat propaganda to get the troops up. And yet, this is not really systematic indoctrination. This is merely commanders trying to inspire troops with material that's on hand at a kind of ad hoc basis that we can look back to Thucydides, you know, and see commanders trying to psych up their troops, by calling on the traditions of the city and playing upon images of one's manhood. What you get really systematic about this is in the French Revolution. During the French Revolution, you have a mass mobilized army, and you have an insecure revolutionary government that wants to use the power of popular communication to secure loyalty to a shaky government that didn't have the traditions of monarchy to fall back on for its legitimacy. So here we actually start to get systematized messages sent out to the armed forces, people being told, you know, in each and every camp, you do this, you tell the troops this. These are the songs we want you to sing, these are the banners we want you to fly, and these are the speeches we want you to make. That was the first systematized effort. When you add to that idea of that a mass army must be dealt with in this kind of managerial way, when you add to that modern communications technologies come of age in the early 20th century, then you have the United States' effort in World War I, which involved mass printing, film, and rapid distribution methods to be able to get out messages to the troops, and very much in common with the French Revolution and those forces of about 110 years earlier, the American Army in World War I believed that the troops' opinion was not something you left to the charisma of the officers or to their own political calculations, but rather opinion ought to be managed. And that was very much also within the Progressive Era's ethos, that you could improve life by organizing it.
Was political indoctrination the sole objective for these early reformers, or do you think they were fulfilling other agendas as well?
You mean, well, you know, once you have opened these channels of communication, you can start pouring in all kinds of content, and a communication system can start serving various agendas. At the core, why would the nation be willing to do this? Why would our society be willing to say, okay, our soldiers' opinions ought to be managed? Well, the only legitimate reason really would be to pursue victory, to produce a willingness to do battle on part of the cause that the government has established, and to win, and to better motivate the troops to win. But that's the slipperiest conclusion that you could possibly come to as to whether this actually works or not. Can you actually motivate somebody to want to fight? Only a little, really. For the most part, we have a very strong instinct of self-preservation, and the things that motivate us to risk our lives are generally not grafted onto us at age 22 or age 24 by a few hours of political lectures. They are things that are formed much, much deeper and have to go deeply into our sources of shame and our sources of love and our sense of community that are developed from, you know, the time that you're 6, 7 years old on. So what does this stuff do? Instead, it can become a vehicle for these other agendas. And, of course, in World War I, the progressives, you know, have a grand old time saying to the United States Army, well, we can practice upon this captive audience a number of projects, one of which was to discourage sexual contact during their time in the military. It was obviously hoped that soldiers would avoid venereal diseases so that they would not be taken out of combat that way. But there was also a very stern moralizing kind of quality to this, where they hoped that if they could occupy soldiers with patriotic thoughts, that they could suppress the sex impulse itself. That's a literal quote. We must suppress the sex impulse itself, which I imagine didn't work that often. But they tried to get rid of dirty pictures, close dancing. They tried to scare the camp followers away from the camps and subject troops to kind of a morally cleansing environment. They were against profanity, and they were also trying to promote an anti-socialist message. Here, we see an example of a kind of conservative brand of progressivism. Progressive today, of course, is sort of a byword for liberals who no longer want to be called liberals because that term somehow become pejorative. But of course, progressives, we're more about an ethos and an approach than a particular set of politics. And from a conservative point of view, taking a large number of men under arms and teaching them to respect industrial authority and the importance of capitalism could perhaps make them, after the war, into a docile industrial labor force. And that message began to creep into the propaganda given to our troops in the end of the, you know, that last year in which the United States was involved in the First World War, and then in the interwar years as well.
Yeah, it's interesting in all of this how the First World War appears to be the first real serious effort to create this sense of citizenship among soldiers. You know, the idea of people from different communities, ethnic communities across the country, shedding those identities to become Americanized. Is this a new development related to the war itself, or is it connected to other political and social forces resident in American society at the time?
That's a good point. You know, we're in the very same years in which public figures are railing against the idea of hyphenated Americans, in which the image of the melting pot is being invoked again and again. And of course, we have a benign view of the idea of the melting pot now. It's sort of gotten the Schoolhouse Rock treatment, and we kind of think very nicely about melting pots. But when you think about a melting pot, it's really a violent image. We're going to be melting you down and building something else out of you, melting away your essential characteristics. The Army, on the surface, you know, these indoctrination programs definitely sort of contain those messages, but there were countervailing messages being given to these troops as well. And those include some accommodation of the fact that there would be units where English was not the primary language spoken. And instead of throwing up their hands and sort of insisting that these troops are going to be Americanized, there's some practical realization that, you know what, we're going to deal with these troops in their native tongue, and we're going to try to, despite the current rhetoric of anti-hyphenating Americans, we're going to try to actually inculcate pride on the basis of you being German Americans or Irish Americans or Italian Americans. So that that did get a little blunted in practice just due to practical considerations.
Interesting. Counterintuitive, but interesting. You also know how, in your book, how prior historians have focused on the primary group dynamic as the chief motivating factor for American soldiers in wartime. Does this render the concept of political motivation somewhat outdated?
Oh, well, you know, I'm sure most people who are listening would be familiar with the primary group theory of combat motivation, but just in case you're not, the idea here is that men essentially will fight only for their buddies, that in the heat of actual battle, abstract concepts of the nation, of the home front, however the soldier might believe in these things in another moment, when they're out in the field, isolated from these other influences of their community, what you're really going to fight for is the men upon whom you've relied and who rely upon you. And this is essentially a kind of a love beyond description, but also a transaction. That these bonds are almost at the pinnacle of human bonding, and yet there's also a very hard calculation here that I must risk my life for these men who are also obligated to risk their life for me, because that is the only way we are going to get through this experience. And it was actually within the auspices of the American information programs in World War II, particularly its research branch, which produced the famous multi-volume studies of the American soldier headed by Samuel Stouffer, a sociologist, and his team, that gave credence to the idea that, no, it's not that flag waving, it's not patriotism, it's not baseball, and it's not apple pie that makes the American soldiers go. It's this reliance on buddies. And the American soldier, the World War II research came out of studying the U.S. soldiers, concluded that really soldiers are quite laconic. And in fact, they would even mock or even sometimes punish overtly patriotic fellows. So going out of the Second World War, very much the hip opinion in terms of how troops were to be motivated was to rely upon these primary group ties and to kind of poo-poo the idea that you had to stoke up the troops by giving them the rationale of the war. And after the non-repatriate scandal in the Korean War, after the failure of the Vietnam War, people began to question whether that conclusion was all that accurate. The biggest problem with the primary group is that if the primary group prioritizes its own survival over the accomplishment of war aims, then all that tight-knit bonding that you're relying upon begins to work against you. You, in the position of the commander, if you have decided that for the purposes of the war we must go take this hill, and the soldiers have decided, based on their primary group bonds, that, you know, that's not a good idea, and that's not worth it, they can use their fellowship really to block out the wishes of their commanders. And particularly after the Vietnam War, the primary group means of motivation began to become qualified. And people said, well, maybe this is the most important thing in terms of why soldiers fight it. But if the primary group does not have an underlying sense that their country is in the right, and it doesn't have to be much more articulated than that, but this basic idea that you're the good guys, then the primary group cannot be used to further to motivate troops towards victory.
That is interesting, Chris. I can't help but think, though, about how that conclusion runs counter to so much of what, you know, our culture has manifested about the primacy of the group of buddies under stress, you know, the band of brothers syndrome that seems to dominate the popular media construction of Americans at war today?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we in one way, I guess, in our popular culture, we've favored stories, movies where the primary group is cynical about war aims, that we like the realism of that, and we've come to embrace the rifleman's war. And that enlightened us in some ways. You know, when we were mostly caught up in what Patton and Eisenhower did and what, you know, what kind of revolvers they had and, you know, who were they, you know, who were they sweet on, and things like that. Maybe we got a little bit away from some kind of intimate knowledge of the men who fought. And most importantly, with Saving Private Ryan, but with all the other phenomena that you've named, we're forced back into confrontation with that rifleman's war, and that was educational in one way. But we may have focused on that at the expense of maybe thinking about some other criticisms of that model.
You know, I wonder if we could also argue that the War Department's concern with political indoctrination was partially a knee-jerk response to fears of Nazi and Imperial Japanese militarism and the effect that would create on their soldiers. I mean, was George Marshall or other figures in the War Department, were they concerned that the German or Japanese soldier was somehow more warlike than the American citizen soldier, and that there was thus a pressing need to convince Americans to fight?
I've never read anything that would make me think that Marshall or a comparable figure, you know, Roosevelt or Eisenhower, thought of it in those kind of comparative terms, that we're less motivated than the enemy. That would be a frequent trope of the anti-communist period, that the communists were so much better motivated than the Americans was a fear of anti-communists. You didn't really have that fear necessarily. What they were responding to especially was a very specific situation in which the draft class of 1940 was due to graduate, you know, due to have their draft expire, their service expire, and instead it was going to have to be renewed. And there were a lot of disgruntled people who felt that they had kept their end of the bargain. They had served in 1940, you know, fortunately for them, the war hadn't come, but they'd still been greatly inconvenienced. You had a robust economy that was shaking off the depression due to the gear up for the war, and there's a great desperation to participate in that economy. And here to be told, no, you know, your moment of danger is not yet over, your chance to get into that burgeoning economy and to get out from military discipline, that's going to be postponed. People who felt themselves very much patriots and you know, very much willing to serve under the initial terms felt double-crossed, and resentment at perhaps being in the Army longer than the initial period of enlistment was the immediate trigger to engage the attention of George Marshall, who was the Army Chief of Staff at the time, have the resources of the Army, of the Roosevelt administration, turned towards this question of placating, not so much placating as winning over or explaining to these soldiers why they were going to have to stay in service. And that very much meant explaining the world situation.
What exactly was the infrastructure for political indoctrination in the Army
during the war? Well, at the beginning, it went through about a number of different name changes, but at the outset, the first thing, impulse was to say, well, what did we do in World War One? Let's pick up that model and revitalize that. World War One had a fairly ambitious effort to propagandize American soldiers very thoroughly and to really invade sort of every aspect of their ideational life. World War II the head said, well, we would like to draw on that talent, but we don't want to go quite so far. They more have conceived of it as basically a morale-boosting element. Who are these soldiers who are talking about going, quote, Ohio over the hill in October when their draft terms expired? They are disgruntled people who need a morale boost. So the Special Services Division is created to administer to the morale of the U.S. Army. And within the Special Services Division, there are multiple branches seeing to various aspects of morale, and three of them had to do with information and education. And what they called information and education included orienting troops. It included providing educational opportunities for morale purposes, and it included non-political information, such as how do you fill out your paperwork, how do you make a medical claim, or you know, how do you get money to your family if there's an emergency, things of that nature. So they all kind of addressed aspects of morale. Now, at the actual unit level, what you would have is you'd have some officer on the staff of the commander as an information officer. And an information officer is basically under the, you know, is not outside the command structure. They're under command of who is ever in command of the unit. They are not political commissars with tremendous power. They are probably much less powerful than a chaplain, for example. And sometimes these jobs are given to officers, frankly, for whom the commander did not have any other use. One commander of the Second World War said, if you can't run a mess, if you can't, you know, clean a sock or fill a balloon, you know, if you can't lead a troop, we'll give you the information job. I often think that if I had been in the war or in any war, I probably would have been an information officer on this basis. You sometimes got people who could read and write and were comfortable talking to groups. But it was essentially the job of this person either to help the commander or to himself speak to the troops on a weekly basis for about 50 minutes about the topic of the day. And that topic might be something that's of particular concern to the troops, or it might have been the latest thing that the Germans have done and the latest thing that the Japanese have done. It almost never worked like it was designed to work. Units that faithfully carried out the weekly meetings were few and far between. Some commanders would pursue it, especially because it maybe gave a break from hard training. You could sort of say, okay, well, we can come off the line a little bit and relax with 50 minutes of this stuff. But for most units, especially the further you got from the United States, a continental United States, the less often these things were actually going to happen. So that's the field aspect of it. Then back at home, you have a collection of civilian talents brought into the Special Services Division to do their thing. This is a big feature of World War II. Baseball players were, you know, basically put in uniform and told to play baseball. Filmmakers were put in uniform and told to make films. Radio announcers and soap opera actors were put in uniform and told to make soap operas and radio shows. There's a large number of names you would probably know. Theodore Geisel, who's Dr. Seuss. William Schreier, who wrote the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, served as information, well, not necessarily information officers, but as lending their special talents to the Special Services Division to craft materials for distribution. And the overall head of the organization in World War II was a man named Frederick Osborne, who, interestingly enough, had been the former president of the American Eugenics Society. And this is, you know, strikes us today as a very odd choice for somebody who's going to go out and give an anti-fascist, anti-master race message, a pluralistic democratic message to speak to an army, a polyglot army. Why would you get a eugenicist? Well, to understand why, you have to understand that the eugenics movement had been under Osborne in the 1930s, rapidly backing away from any association with master race theories in Germany, and had taken up an anti-Nazi position. And no eugenics arguments ever really filtered into the American propaganda effort in the Second World War. Osborne played it very straight. I contrast him in the book. His choice was sort of the old army choice. He was the sort of guy that the interwar army respected as an intellect and a good type of person to organize things. But the army that they were creating in World War II, you could identify more strongly with one of the people that they brought into Special Services Division, the most famous being Frank Capra, the director of many popular films, most famously at that point. He had done It Happened One Night with Claudia Colbert and Clark Gable in 1934, a famous road movie, which more or less invented the genre of romantic comedies in our films. And Capra was brought in to make the propaganda films that would be palatable to a wide range of Americans. Well, I don't know that there's an average soldier. With 12 million men under arms at any one time, and 16 million, for the entire war, naturally you can find every type of response there is in the memoirs of soldiers. You won't be surprised, to have me tell you that some soldiers rejected this propaganda outright. They said, this is propaganda. I won't be propagandized. I'm not for this. There were soldiers who loved it, who had fond memories, especially of Capra's films. There were soldiers who felt it did not go far enough. I quote one soldier of Eastern European descent in the book, who was already a strident anti-communist because he'd escaped from Eastern Europe, had a much closer inkling of what was going on in the Soviet Union, and thinking there was not nearly enough anti-communism in these works, because naturally the United States wasn't saying anything nasty about the Soviet Union and its propaganda during World War II. It was rather trying to cultivate respect for this ally, to make people understand that the United States might have to give the Soviets a great deal of money, for example, or loan them equipment. So it wasn't really in their interests. Some anti-communists very much keyed on that, even during the war. Some troops felt, I think this was an interesting reaction, said, we knew it was propaganda, but we liked it anyway. And that's particularly, I think, attributable to Frank Capra's film. You think about It's a Wonderful Life, right, which is on every Christmas, and many people have seen it multiple times. And maybe I hope I'm not speaking only to the people who've seen that film, but if I could speak to them for a minute, think about it. You know you're being manipulated by Frank Capra, and you like it anyway, I would assume, right? I mean, if you're watching it more than once at this late date, you know it's kind of cornball, but you're willing to buy in. And that's why he was a great choice as a propagandist, because it's not deceptive. Your heartstrings are being played on a little bit, and yet you accept it. You're willing to roll with it because it's given to you just sweet enough that it goes down easy. So that was a reaction that many troops had. It's interesting to single out certain types of troops. Japanese-American troops, for example, I didn't find many quotations from them with high regard for the propaganda effort. More often, they're sort of marveling at themselves for having bought into a larger propaganda atmosphere that they had to somehow prove themselves to a nation that had proven so disloyal to them. It was somehow up to them to provide the proof of loyalty. And that didn't come from any wartime materials, but from some kind of larger community, sense of community. there were some special efforts made to try to address African-American troops. And one film by Capra, the Negro Soldier, tried to inculcate pride for African-American forces, but also to provide a kind of lesson in teamwork and tolerance for any white for troops who were viewing the film. You will get quotations from black soldiers occasionally, again, marveling at the simplicity of this propaganda and how it did not address the what they regarded as the real American situation.
You know, another question comes to mind about the actual people who are involved in this work. Did you find any examples of individuals who sought to use their position to promote their own political agenda?
Yes, frequently. In many ways harmlessly, and in a couple of ways really overboard. When I began the project, I imagined that anyone who would take the propaganda job must be sort of ideologically committed. And they you can call your attention to, there's an episode of MASH back in the Frank Burns years, when they portrayed, and I believe this is the only fictional portrayal of this that's out there, they portrayed an actual troop information session on this episode of MASH, in which the Frank Burns character is giving an anti-communist lecture, and Hawkeye Pierce, the wise, you know, Weisenheimer doctor, the only member of the audience, because he's trying to stay up all night or something like this, and he kind of heckles Frank from the back of the room. And I almost imagine, although I'd not seen this episode at the time, I almost imagine that must be what it was like. You know, anti-communist lecturers, preaching to troops whose political commitment was much lesser, or took them with a great deal of skepticism, took these politicized figures. In actuality, there were probably more Hawkeyes in front of the room than there were Franks. The political indoctrination job, the information officer job, seemed to attract an iconoclastic person at the unit level. At the unit level, you have accounts of indoctrination leaders who constantly question the material that they'd been given by the Army or the Pentagon, who punched it up and made it funny for their troops, tried to entertain with their lectures, and kind of put on an air of skepticism about the whole thing. You also had a reaction about that. The first inclination that there was going to be a big anti-communist and also just politically conservative reaction against the troop indoctrination efforts came when Winston Churchill, when his party was not reelected in 1945. Promptly dismissed by British electorate, Churchill famously wrote. Observers said, part of the reason Churchill lost is our pinko troop indoctrinators have been telling our troops to vote a Labor, and they're subversives. American conservatives in the Army began to say, who's taking these jobs as information lecturers? In the words of one intelligence officer, they said these are subversives and cowards. It's a haven for liberals who are, proto-communists. And these charges often, boiled down to nothing more than the idea that there were liberals amongst the troop indoctrinators, and that the troop indoctrination program, it was officially called the Troop Information and Education Program, was putting out a message of racial tolerance. That was enough to raise the hackles of conservatives. Racial tolerance they seeing as the potential underminer of what they considered proper American values. So the counter-reaction then from the top, and by the top I mean usually the Pentagon officer in charge of the service's individual programs, was to try to increase the anti-communist stridency of the program. And when a strident anti-communism entered the program in the mid-50s, there was always anti-communist, but since the Second World War, began to get these harsher measures around 1955 and afterward. This encouraged officers who may have been, not merely conservative, but ultra-conservative, or members of the radical right, depending on what term you think is most appropriate, to sometimes politicize themselves, to come out against the sitting Democratic administrations, especially to decry the nation's seeming acceptance of continued communist domination of Eastern Europe. This boiled over when the most extreme views of some officers were manifest in the commander of the 24th Division stationed in Augsburg in West Germany in 1961, a man named Edwin Walker, Major General Edwin Walker, began to indoctrinate his troops with a program called Pro-Blue. Pro-Blue was allegedly a positive program in contrast to an anti-Red program, you see. On paper, it was sort of like a political indoctrination taken very seriously. Walker was not just going to go through the motions. He assigned a large number of personnel to doing speeches, lectures, loudspeaker vans, pamphlets, a whole layer of material generated by the offices of the 24th Division to not only its members, but also to the civilian friends and families of the 24th Division, including their German friends, right, in Germany. And worse than anything else, Walker began giving speeches to his division's parent-teacher association, to the PTA, so military personnel, their spouses, and their teachers, their children's teachers. And the message that Walker put out in some of his speeches was basically an endorsement of a voting guide prepared by the John Birch Society, sort of saying you ought to vote for these ultra-conservative candidates. He attacked the Kennedy administration as being weak on communism. This is right after the Bay of Pigs, so the Kennedy administration was especially sensitive to criticism at this moment. And he also threw in some gratuitous things, like he called Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry Truman pinkos, as well as Samuel Yorty, the mayor of Los Angeles, and also some of his superiors in the Department of Defense. And this created a public scandal, and this resulted in Walker being recalled, and he resigned to go into politics. Edwin Walker turned up later on the campus of the University of Mississippi when Ole Miss was when James Meredith was integrating the school, and there's chaos that had broken out due to a racist reaction against Meredith's integration on the campus of Ole Miss. And there, to the surprise, to the shock of the Kennedy administration, was Edwin Walker. And in a way, is very lamentable about Walker's career, because Walker had actually won praise as one of the commanders involved in the integration of Little Rock High School in Arkansas back in 1955. He squandered those laurels here at Ole Miss, claiming that Meredith was the Antichrist come to destroy the University of Mississippi and the United States generally, at which point ran for governor of Texas on the Democratic ticket, and strangely enough, I should back up. When Kennedy heard that Walker was there on the campus, he remarked to his aides, he said, can you believe that that son of a bitch was a major general, had a division? And the Kennedy advisors were kind of laughing, and they said, well, you know, he's like, the Burt Lancaster character in the military coup movie 7 Days in May. And Kennedy said, you know, I didn't really like the president in that movie. He wasn't very good. And it goes out of Kennedy's mind at that point. But tragically, the men are linked once again. Lee Harvey Oswald, in a resident of Texas, attempted to assassinate Governor Walker, candidate Walker, did not kill Walker, but apparently grazed him, and was later found that he had been using the same rifle which he eventually used to assassinate Kennedy in November of 1963. So a weird linkage between those two guys, you know. Once again.
Amazing. You know, you note that between Korea and Vietnam, the military's efforts mirror those taking place in the larger civilian world in promoting what we describe as a robust Americanism, a civic religion based on rituals of participation. Yeah, this is also a period of dramatic civic upheaval in the United States. I mean, particularly with reference to civil rights and, you know, of course, the rise of the McCarthyite, virulent anti-communist discourse in domestic politics. Can you describe how it's possible to frame any sort of political consensus within this environment?
Eventually you can't. Eventually it breaks down. In the 50s, you could try. In the 1950s, when I say, you know, rituals of participation, I'm really kind of trying to point out anti-communist did not allow you just to be sort of passively anti-communist. Sitting on the sidelines was not always an option for Americans in these years. They were being constantly cajoled to participate, to come to meetings, to affirm your anti-communism. This was regarded sort of an irritation by a lot of Americans. It was a kind of a constant claim on their attention in these years. And yet, the very fear of communism demanded somehow that Americans collect a series of ideas that unified them as a response. They didn't feel this need to respond to fascism in this way. Fascism was, you know, you're at war with it by the time you're arguing with it. Communism, there is no war taking place of the argument, and the communists were making claims that were somehow rooted in the Western tradition of values. In particular, you know, claims of humanity and equality. Arne Odd Westad, who wrote The Global Cold War, one time compared the two empires, the United States' empire and the Soviet empire, as the United States being the empire of liberty and the Soviets being the empire of justice. Well, not many Americans thought that was a real, you know, that the Soviets really were an empire of justice, but the claim was out there, and therefore you had felt this need to answer it in a way that you didn't need to answer before. So how do you answer this in terms of an American consensus when the communists are taking pot shots at American hypocrisies on race, on pointing out poverty amidst wealth in Western countries? So you get a forging of this kind of consensus in the 50s, and I'll give you a couple of examples. Certain positions we would regard as basically being liberal positions win out. All this anti-communist stuff is not essentially conservative. It's essentially a fusion between liberal and conservative values. Liberal values, for example, include interventionism, the idea that the United States is going to be an active, constant part of the world, that the United States has a responsibility to other countries, to international systems beyond national interests. These are liberal values. These are not really, you know, conservative values would place the nation state first and then kind of go forward from there. So that wins. A second one is the idea of unions. Now, here we are in a country today where we have about 12% of our workforce unionized, and unions are under fire, you know, all over the country. But at the time, in the 50s, it was closer to, I believe, about over a third of the workforce was unionized, and unions are enjoying considerable political popularity. U.S. material said, propaganda material said, we accept unions. Unions are our solution to labor capital problems, which we have left behind us. We now have unions and management to make the small adjustments we need to keep everything fair and to keep everything going. Conservative values are more obvious in some ways in the program, emphasizing individual responsibility and military traditions. But around this, and religion also, contrasting Soviets were and communists were officially atheist, with the United States being a Judeo-Christian country. The very phrase Judeo-Christian country is something that gets emphasized a lot in the 1950s as opposed to later. As opposed to earlier, when there would be actual friction between Catholics, Jews, and Protestants. Moving forward in the 50s, to build consensus, you say, well, no, we are all Judeo-Christians. We include all these groups, and it's more important that all three of us are anti-communist than any differences we might have amongst ourselves. So you begin to get this idea that there's this consensus set of values that's being run out there. The most contentious issue in the 50s was race relations. To what degree could the military endorse any kind of consensus on race when the country was obviously deeply divided on race? And the military took the position that it supported the idea that white people and black people could work together, but that the army itself was not an engine of social change in the South. Well, that just wouldn't cut it for very long. As you move into the 60s, a couple of things happen. The Walker scandal and the waning of McCarthyism and Hooverism in the 1960s, a more detached analytical view of anti-communism than the emotional one you had in the 50s comes to the fore. The Kennedy administration liked to say, hey, there's no place here for amateur anti-communists, for people looking for communists under their bed and things like that. Instead, we're going to be these sophisticated analysts who attack the communists at their pressure points in the third world. We're not going to run around with our heads, you know, kind of cut off. We're going to be altogether more serious. The Walker scandal, which is a minor one in the political events of the 1950s, although important to me, you know, and to the story of political indoctrination, also cools off the ardor that Congress had and the right wing had for forwarding an aggressive indoctrination of the troops. So moving into the 60s. The political consensus that they had forged in the 50s was jeopardized by the obvious divisions over civil rights. You didn't have the anti-communist impulse at the same intensity to overcome that. And the indoctrination program becomes less and less political. By the time you get to the Vietnam War, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force are arguing openly that, hey, we shouldn't be involved in shaping people's political opinions, which is very much not their attitude, you know, in the 1950s. The Pentagon still felt that they had a role to play, and the Pentagon leadership still saw things in terms of the anti-communist impulse. But even the services underneath them, you know, weren't there.
Is it safe to say the propaganda mission or the propaganda effort became confused in Vietnam then? You know, lost between indoctrination on the one hand and public relations on the other?
Yeah, I mean, commanders became quite fearful, although they really had no reason to fear that that a Ted Walker would be done to them. They nevertheless oftentimes felt that, hey, I'm not putting myself out there on a limb to be attacked for trying to indoctrinate our troops. And the disgrace of Walker allowed many, many commanders to revert to their original opinion, which was, hey, I never thought this indoctrination stuff was going to work anyway. It's all nonsense. Let me get back to training my troops, you know, the way they ought to be trained. I'm not up here to give political lessons. So what you have from the Army is saying a reaffirmation of our apolitical tradition. So we're not going to tell you why we're in Vietnam. We're not going to, you know, make that a centerpiece of your training. The Pentagon can't really respond in anything other than these 1950s terms, the encroachment of communism as this constant threat, and that there's constant communist subversion at home that the troops ought to be concerned about. What goes missing in these two disparate kind of impulses is a realistic attempt to orient soldiers sent to Vietnam as to the local conditions in Vietnam. This mission is not entirely abandoned, but it's definitely deprioritized. And I would argue much to the detriment of American troops. You can't necessarily claim that a better indoctrination effort would have made the United States much more militarily effective in Vietnam than it was. But I would argue that you have the responsibility to try, at any rate, to give the soldiers on the ground as many tools as they can to cope with, you know, what we now call counterinsurgency war. And those tools were really not forthcoming in Vietnam because the Army wasn't interested in politicizing itself, and the Pentagon could only think in terms of big geopolitical issues. After Vietnam, it's pretty much gone. It begins to concentrate solely on those sorts of issues that were at one point only a minor part of the morale effort that I mentioned before in World War II, in particular helping soldiers navigate the bureaucracy, informing them of important dates and forms and such, making available to them absentee ballots but not really pushing them, and addressing questions of race relations and drug use and abuse. After the war, there was a doubling down on the idea of trying to help soldiers with their lives rather than preaching at them in any way, shape, or form. One response, perhaps a cynical one, it's been detailed by some social scientists that the Army, instead of trying to confront soldiers politically and say, whatever your political objections are, this is how we argue against them, instead began to say, well, we should just deal with soldiers' disaffections by transferring them, you know, letting them wear their hair longer, or having ice cream twice a week, or something to that effect, basically saying we won't meet, you know, you on the political battlefield. We'll just try to adjust your circumstances so we don't, you know, don't hear as many complaints out of you.
So what happens to the Army's political indoctrination program?
And I don't know what your impression is of what we're doing today, but, you know, since we've moved to the all-volunteer force, that was what I've just described was sort of the way to go for about the first 10 years. Eventually, when you get into a series of conflicts, there is some, you know, always recognition that you need some area orientation training, you know, that you need to be able to tell people something about where they're going. And what I've seen typically, you know, these days is PowerPoints with a lot of flowcharts.
Yeah, there's nothing quite as inspiring as a PowerPoint presentation.
Well, I don't think they're that emotionally inspirational.
Oh, don't I know it. So tell us, Chris, what's next? Where do you go from here?
Well, what I'd like to do next, and I have some time to work on it right now, so I'm very excited about it, is I'm trying to write a political and social history of Reconstruction-era soldiers, particularly soldiers who are still in U.S. uniform, serving in the South during the occupation and, you know, sort of scanty occupation of the South up to 1877. At various times, you had between 100,000 troops and 10,000 troops in over this vast area. And the anti-Reconstruction forces are generally very careful not to engage them, not to provoke federal troops. Because those federal troops lacked cavalry units with which they could go around and chase the Ku Klux Klan, they tended to have any mission that they might execute be a rather frustrating one. What I'm curious about, though, is once again returning to the nexus of politics and individual soldiers. How did they regard that mission? To what degree were soldiers as frustrated as I suspect that they were? To what degree are they just trying to get along in the South? Are they more sort of naturally sympathetic to the disenfranchised African Americans who are struggling to realize the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and their Republican allies? Or are they more sympathetic perhaps to the dispossessed of the war, which would include many white Democrats as well? And a history of their interactions, and especially in the culminating campaign against the Klan in 1871, is what I'm hoping to be able to really get my teeth into.
No, that sounds good, Chris. Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you. I hope it's as fun as this last one, which was really fun to talk about with you again. And not only thanks for inviting me, but thanks to anyone who's listened to this. It's very kind of you.
Thank you for joining us, Chris.
You've been listening to our interview with Christopher DeRosa, author of the book Political Indoctrination in the U.S. Army from World War II to the Vietnam War. This is your host, Bob Wintermute, for New Books in Military History. Thank you for listening.